John Brunner calls him consistently the most brilliant science fiction writer in the field. His name is Philip K. Dick, and why science fiction? Rather than all the forms of literature you could have chosen, why SF? Was it a conscious decision?
Yes, there's more latitude in science fiction for the expression of pure ideas than you find in other genres.
Let's get rid of a couple of clichés first. SF is a ghetto. People say, yeah, it's a ghetto, and then on the other hand they say it's a literature of ideas. All literature is supposed to be a literature of ideas, right? So why is it that science fiction gets tagged with that, and in the same breath is tagged as a ghetto, and people can put it down and pay a lot less money and get a lot less recognition and so forth?
Well, science fiction has changed a lot in the last few years. It's coming out of the ghetto. But all it's done is make it worse. I mean, the writing is worse now that it's coming out of the ghetto. Instead of getting better, it's getting worse because it's losing its identity, it's losing its shape. It's becoming like silly putty. I mean, you can now call anything you want science fiction, or you can decide not to call it science fiction. Like, I have a book coming out, the hardcover edition will be called mainstream, and the paperback is going to be sold as science fiction. If you buy the hardcover, you're reading a mainstream novel. If you buy the Valentine paperback, you're reading a science fiction novel. But the text is identical in the two. And they're bought simultaneously by Doubleday and Ballantyne, working in tandem. So if I were to talk to you about my novel, I'd have to ask you whether you read the Doubleday edition or the Ballantyne paperback edition. Now, if you read the Ballantyne paperback edition, I'd say, yes, that was a great science fiction novel. And if you read the Doubleday edition, I'd say, well, that was a great mainstream novel, wasn't it, Mike?
Interesting.
You'd be hard put to figure out how to respond when it's strictly a way of packaging it. We're not talking about packaging and marketing. We're not talking about content at all. Like Sharon Jarvis at Doubleday read the first 80 pages. He says, well, there's no rocket ships in this book. That's not science fiction. I'm going to throw it down the hall to the other editors, the trade editors. No, let them market it. And then Ballantyne looked at the manuscript and said, hot dog, this is wonderful science fiction. We're going to make millions. And then I said, you guys better get together. So I really don't know. I mean, it came out of the... It came out of the ghetto in the hardcover edition, and it went right back into the ghetto in the paperback edition.
Which do you hope sells more, the softcover with the SF tag or Doubleday mainstream?
I hope, oh boy, now you've really put me against the wall. That's a very evil question to ask.
That's right.
Because I can't answer without offending somebody. That is, I have to sit on two stools at once, and I have to... You know, hype the science fiction one, and I have to turn around and hype the mainstream one. I can't fault either one without immediately becoming a victim of my own trap.
Okay, well, let's see if we can rephrase it so it may not offend quite as many people.
I don't want to offend anybody. All right, inoffensive novel will not offend any reader anywhere. No bad words. That's another thing. It could not be published as science fiction by Doubleday because it had four-letter words in it. And their science fiction list does not allow four-letter words in the book. There were too many of them to remove them. If there had only been a few, like in Deus Iri, which they bought from me and Roger Zelazny, there were only a few four-letter words, so they inked them out, and they marketed as science fiction. And I had never known this before. I didn't know that the distinction between science fiction and mainstream was the number of four-letter words. But on this new one of mine, Larry Ashmead, the editor-in-chief at Doubleday, says, you can't take them out. They're necessary to the book. Therefore, we can't market it as science fiction. So we're down to basics now. If you want it marketed as a mainstream novel, you say bleep, bleep all the way through the book. And if you get enough bleep, bleeps in the book, they can't market it as science fiction because they figure most of the science fiction market is kids. You know, this is their theory. This is not my theory. But they're envisioning this audience, but with the thick glasses and the acne, you know, parting the hair in the middle, you know, and the overcoat guy bought at the Salvation Army in a suitcase of old magazines, and he has a felt pen that he wants you to sign every copy of every Astounding that he's got. That's their idea of the science fiction market. That's their idea. That's not my idea.
This is Doubleday, the premier hardcover.
Well, I'm not saying market. I mean Doubleday. I just mean them.
Them. Oh, yeah. The well-known
them. The well-known them. The people that run things.
So that's the distinction. If it's got enough four-letter words, it's not science.
That's right. And that's not what I was told this by an editor-in-chief who is now not with Doubleday. He went over to Simon Schuster. I think that...
Their homework. How does he explain, or did you ask him about somebody like Delaney with Dahlgren? Well, definitely SF, and it's got lots of 4 and 10-letter words.
Yeah, that's true. I read part of it. Harlan Ellison and I agree that's a terrible book. I mean, even though it had a lot of 4-letter and 10-letter words, it was still a terrible book. It should have been marketed as trash. That's what it should have been marketed. There's a category, you know. There's trash. It's just trashy novels.
Sci-fi and trashy novels. Yeah. Okay, why? Why is it a bad book? Is it just?
Oh, it's just a bad book. I don't have to go into that. I mean, it's not necessary that I be a literary critic. I don't know anything about that. That's not my field. I can't criticize. I just read Star Reading, and I said, this is the worst trash I've ever read. And I threw it away. And Harlan did the same thing, sitting up there in Sherman Oaks, where he lives on the pinnacle of that steep hill. Harlan is not in it for profit. Harlan is in it for the ideology of science fiction. He's
done
so much.
Harlan is leaving the field of science fiction.
He
says, I write what I write. Yeah, he's doing his, I write Harlan Ellison stories. They're not science fiction.
That's a tautology. Harlan Ellison writes Harlan Ellison stories. That's the predicate is implied by the subject. I listed the people for Publishers Weekly who had left science fiction recently. I didn't even think to add Harlan. I remember now. I did read Harlan's letter in FNSF, I believe, where he said, "America, sleep it or bleep it," regarding science fiction. Barry Maltzberg published the most marvelously crazy statement of the universe in all the history of science fiction. Nobody has ever bum-tripped science fiction as much as Barry Maltzberg did, you know, and I think he's a great writer, but that's not the way, you don't break up a marriage that way, you don't leave science fiction that way, by saying everybody in it is rotten, everything that's ever been written is rotten, except what I wrote. That wasn't rotten, which is what Maltzberg said. But he's going on to bigger and greater things. And then Vonnegut, this is what I said at Published Week, Vonnegut has always never written science fiction. He discovered when, upon looking back over his career, discovered he'd made a lot of money at some point. And at that point, retroactively, he, like the Pope, you know, everything I say is true, and I never was writing science fiction. Even if you read Player Piano and you thought it was science fiction, you were wrong. And Cat's Cradle, likewise, and Siren of the Tide. They're not science fiction, because I say they're not science fiction. Come to me, I will tell you. Harlan says, come to me, I will tell you.
Silverberg is also leaving the field.
I know.
Tom Dish.
He's rich. Silverberg's rich.
Well,
I don't know how come he is. I can't figure it out, because none of the rest of us are. I've always asked him that same question over and over again. He just smiles with that sort of superior enigmatic smile of his. And, you know, which means that I know something you don't know, and that's why I'm rich and you're not. He didn't make it off science fiction. I don't believe he made it off selling science fiction. If he did, he sure does know something I don't know. I think he reinvested his royalties in a pizza plant or something.
I don't know why, but there's something about your style of writing and your style, as I discerned it from the Rolling Stone piece, the Paul Williams article, that puts me in mind of Kilgore Trout.
And that's Phil Jose Farmer.
Yeah, right, I know. I mean, I don't mean you are
I don't understand
Kilgore Trout.
Mean.
I mean
no
that
Kilgore
you're...
Trout.
All right, you do writing which is excellent, and it is labeled science fiction, and therefore it don't sell nothing. It winds up next to the bra and the
wrong
ads.
Wrong. Doubleday gets to market it through their El Cheapo book club. Oh boy, will they love to hear this. But that's true. They get to sell it for $1, and the author makes a penny then, or something trivial like that. His royalties off the entire... Robert Heinlein explained this to me one time. He said, you sell a book to a hardcover publisher, and the Doubleday Book Club snatches it right up and markets it for $1, no matter how many pages it's got. I mean, we're speaking in hyperbole here, but nevertheless, then your royalties immediately descend down to the minuscule level again. The more copies it sells, the less money you make. Heinlein says that he was financially ruined when they picked up Like Stranger in a Strange Land, I believe it was, one of his recent ones, because they immediately marketed this giant thing for $1. And his royalties, you said, it destroyed the trade edition. He says, the worst thing that can happen to you. I always thought it was good when I had a book picked up by the Doubleday Book Club. But I found I made no money. I looked at my royalty sheets. I made no money. That's where the money is, though, you see, is marketing it through like a book club thing. And the publisher makes the money, but the author doesn't. He makes his 10% of the flat price on the trade edition only. And what they do is this. They print up about 2,000 copies of the trade edition. They sell 500 of them, and they pulp the rest the next day. I didn't know that. That was almost enough to leave the field of writing entirely. An editor, two editors, told me that this is actually what happens. A hardcover publisher puts out a science fiction novel and pulps his trade edition immediately and turns it over to the book club. So the author looks at his royalty sheet and he says, that's really strange. He says, no matter how good my novel is, it will only sell 2,000 copies. It always stops at 2,000 copies. Because that's at the point that the publisher decided to pulp the edition. I was told that in one of my recent hardcover novels, I won't name the publisher, because this is secondary, jad. I mean, I just have this editor's word for it. After they'd sold 500 copies, they pulped the entire edition. For no reason at all. Except it made it available immediately for subsidiary rights.
What about paperback?
Well, that's the subsidiary. I mean, selling directly the paperback.
Yeah, right.
Well, somebody told me that's where the fat money is. It's selling directly the paperbacks. That was a paperback publisher told me that. And then they offered me all the money you ever saw in your life to do a novel for them. But when they actually talked specifically, rather than just saying, we'll give you all the money you ever wanted and then some, it turned out to be less than if I sold it to a hardcover house and there was a Doubleday book club edition and then a paperback. So in the paperback, under those conditions, you split the royalties 50-50 with the hardcover publisher. It still turned out to be less, right? Because like in Ubik, I got $10,000 for the paperback, of which I got $5,000, Doubleday got the other five. And, like recently, Daw offered me $6,000 to do an original novel for him. And for Daw, $6,000 is like them selling you all the office furniture they've got, including all their computers and things. You know, that's about all the money Daw has is $6,000. If you were to project $6,000 for Daw, say, what would Bantam then pay? Or Dell, who really racked. Like, Bantam has 17,500 outlets in the United States that say own 17,500 racks. Isn't that incredible? That's the largest number of racks that any publisher owns in this country. And Daw doesn't own any racks that I know of. I've never seen a Daw rack. And they're up to 6,000.
Are you going to do it? Are you going to write the book for
Daw? Oh, yes. I'm going to have a ball doing it, too. It's going to be a lot of fun. But that's Don Wolheim, and he gave me my start.
That's a good cue to pick up some biographical type stuff. You started when?
51.
51. When you sold your first story. How long had you been writing before you sold your first story?
Ever since I could operate a typewriter, which was when I taught myself to type when I was 12. And I wrote my first novel when I was 14. It was called Return to Lilliput. It was really a bomb. It was terrible. It was the worst novel. I'll sell it someday. I'll find a market for it. It was really neat. They rediscovered Lilliput in the modern world, like rediscovering Atlantis. These guys report they've discovered Lilliput. But it's only accessible by submarine because it's sunk under the water. You think a 14-year-old kid would have a more original idea than that. And I even can tell you the numbers on the submarines. I had to go visit them. It was A101, B202, C303 were the numbers and names of the designations of the submarines.
Makes it a finite number of submarines, though.
Yeah, well, I realized that when I got halfway through. I wasn't thinking ahead.
You sold your first story then to Don Wolheim?
No, to Tony Boucher at FNSF.
That's a hell of a way to begin. That's pretty good. I mean, FNSF in 51 was even sold.
Oh, yes. It was the highest class magazine in existence at that time. And what I did was I sent out 13 or 14 stories, and they all came back, including the one I sent to FNSF. Only Tony Boucher said, if you rewrite it along these lines, you will have a worthwhile piece of fiction, because he was the greatest editor, and I mean, he was a great writer, great anthologizer, great editor, great person. And like, I had sent him 8,000-9,000 words, and I cut it down to about 2,000 words. That was a story called Rogue, and it's still in print. It's still in print now. It's in print in a
text story for
high school students.
It's in paperback, in one of your, a paperback collection of short stories, the only collection of short stories I've ever seen.
It's in the preserving machine?
I think it is.
It's also, Silverberg picked it up. In other words, it's still in print. It's all these years later, 25, 26 years later. And I'm still getting money off the darn thing. It's really weird. I'm still making money off stuff I wrote, when I was just starting. They're still in print, those early stories of mine. But then I hit a bad part of my career. About 1954, when I started writing the worst trashy stuff you ever, none of that stuff's in print. You know, I like it. It was, you know, complete, you know, started out very good. I started as a really good writer under Tony Boxer's direction. And in 1953, I sold 27 stories that year. And 26 of the 27 were rotten, worthless pieces of fiction. And my agent had to tell me, you know, his best friends won't tell him. My agent said, Phil, write fewer, better stories. The fewest, the best. Maybe one a year, because they were really terrible. But they were all being purchased.
What about the first novel you sold?
That was The Dunn Wall Hunt. That was Solar Lottery. And that's still in print. That's been in print off and on for about 20 years. And I've made about $1,500 off it.
And you know, over that there. Is what I mean about...
That's what I mean. Trout. That's what I mean. Oh, is that what you mean
that's
about Silver
what I mean. A man who is virtually unparalleled in the field. Nobody knows you. You're, you know, you could... If you'll pardon the hyperbole, be starving to death in a field. You're damn good. You're still going to make $1,500, and
yeah, I got $1,000 advance on the book, and then when they reprinted 10 years later, they gave me $500, and that's the last I ever saw of any money off that book. And it's still in print. I could walk over there and pull a copy out of the bookcase, and it still bears the original publishing date. There's no like second, third printing of the further dates. It still says copyright Ace Books, 1954, or whatever it is. Which is almost borders on the illegal, for them to copyright it rather than giving me the copyright. It means I can't get a reversion on them, where I would get title again, because I never had title. They took copyright on their name, and they just recycle that book, and they recycle it all over the world. People find it in Hong Kong, you know, and the royalty sheets show no copies have been sold since 1954 or something like that.
They print a lot, they just hope. Of all the novels you have written, I guess, I don't know, my own particular favorites, A Man in the High Castle, of course, Ubik.
What do the French call it? Ubik. Dix Ubik.
And,
I don't know, it's called Ubik Mio Signora in Italian. They had, I guess that means Ubik, my dear sir, or something like that. Well, it does, because I looked it up.
Okay. Shit, arguing. What about your own working habits? How do you work? Or do you have a pattern indeed? Is it just...
Well, I used to just write all the time. I used to just get up at noon and sit down at the typewriter and write until 2 a.m. Just write from noon in the morning until 2 a.m. You got to do that when you start out, or you're going to die on the vine. I mean, you've got to just, you know, you've always... You know, you're going to live on $2,000 a year, and you're going to eat rocks and dirt and weeds from the backyard for the first 10 years. And then after the first 10 years, you get to eat instant breakfast. You work up to, you're rich enough to get a phone put in, and you get to buy an old automobile. Does it sound like a car truck? It does, doesn't it? I'm afraid it does. And you get to drive around in an old Hupmobile, which you crank start every morning. And then after 25 years, you manage to get a used Dodge. It costs you $795. The radio doesn't work in it. You know, and there's people that are standing behind grocery counters are making more money. One time I was in Trader Joe's at the grocery store, and I was talking to the clerk, and he made more money than I did. And I was really sore. I really took it bad. Because he had just hired him. He didn't even have seniority as a grocery clerk. I mean, at least he could have been a senior clerk. I said, how much do you make? And he says, such and such. And I says, jeepers, that's a lot of money.
You do that enough. You get to the point of, you know, what the hell? Why am I beating my brains out for $2,000 a year, or $4,000, or even $10,000?
Well, then I answer. I love to write, and I'd write it if they didn't pay me anything.
He's only kidding. He's only kidding, Bantam. He's only kidding.
Oh yeah, that ain't too cool to say. Well, I say that a lot, but you try to. I got an agent who doesn't agree with me. I don't market my own stuff. I market through the toughest, meanest dude in the world. Scott Meredith. You can't jip him. It's impossible to jip Scott Meredith. Because if you do, don't start your car up in the morning.
At least not without checking the engine.
Yeah. Pulling the hood open and looking for extra wires.
So you do like to write. So you said you used to work nonstop?
Yes.
Have you changed that pattern?
Yes. Yes. Now, here's what happened to me. This novel that I spoke about earlier, Deus Irae, that Roger Zelazny and I wrote. It took us 12 years to write it. That's really true. We figured it out. I signed a contract with Doubleday in 1964. This is 1976, right? Well, that's how long it took the two of us. I couldn't even write it alone. I mean, I got like, you know, a third of it done. And I discovered I didn't know anything about the subject matter, which was Christianity. I could sing a few hymns, you know, and I could cross myself. And that was about all. And I had, you know, embarked on a theological novel without knowing anything about theology. So I ran across Zelazny in 1968. I had been working 4 years on a novel. And I said, Zelazny, you know anything about theology? He says, you better believe it, Jack. I said, how'd you like to collaborate with me? I got one third of this thing done. It's all about Christianity. So he took it. And then, like, you know, 8 years went by. And I didn't hear from Roger. You know, I got a postcard one time from the East Coast, you know. I said, Roger's over his head. This is like just like me. He's doing research. Now I've learned what you do. So at the end of 12 years, we were able to complete it finally. We each got $400 a piece or something like that. In other words, it was, you know, like the greatest disaster of our joint careers was that novel. We'll never be able to earn back what we put into it in the way of research and work. Now I spend my time doing research before I do the book. I'm not going to get burned like that again. I'm working on another theological novel called To Scare the Dead. But I've done 2 years of research. When I sit down at the typewriter, I'm going to know what I'm talking about. Man in the High Castle, I did 7 years of research for Man in the High Castle. 7 years of research. I did other stuff, too, during those 7 years. But it took me 7 years to amass the material on the Nazis and the Japanese, especially on the Nazis, before I could sit down and write. That's probably the reason why it's a better novel than most of my novels, that I knew what I was talking about. I knew, and there wasn't anything I didn't know. I had prime source material at the Berkeley Cal Library from the Gestapo, you know, that they had seized after World War II. It was marked for the eyes of the higher police, and the higher police is a term for obfuscopic, I hate those people, I really. I was forced to read Gestapo diaries of Gestapo men in Warsaw, Gestapo agents. I had to read that stuff. I had to sit there, because you couldn't take it out of the library. You had to read it in the stacks. I had to read what those guys wrote in their private journals to write Man in the High Castle. And that's why I've never written a sequel to it, because it's too horrible, it's too awful. I started several times to write a sequel to it, and I had to go back and, you know, read about Nazis again. And I'd just like to off every one of them, is what I'd like to do, you know. But, and so I could never do a sequel to it. Somebody would have to come in and help me do a sequel to it. Someone who had the stomach for the stamina to think along those lines, you know, to get into the head. You know, start writing about Reinhard Heydrich, for instance. You have to get into his space. Can you imagine getting into Reinhard Heydrich's space? Now, Condon, you know, Richard Condon, is that his name, wrote Manchurian Candidate? Yeah, he wrote a thing called Infinity of Mirrors about Reichsführer Himmler. And he knew everything there was to know about Himmler. He got into Himmler's head. Condon has the guts to do that. I could not do that again. That's why the book is, my book, Man in the High Castle, set in the Japanese part, you see. Because then I could deal with people, you know. But, I'd have little glimpses of the Nazi part, like when Mr. Tagomi hears his printout on, you know, a personality traits of the Nazi contenders for Reichschancellor. And he runs out and gets sick, falls down.
That was you.
That was me. Horrible, he said, horrible. Evil is real like cement. Evil is... There's a pun, concrete, cement, you see? But he's thinking. His thoughts are all jumbled up.
Did you know it was going to be that torturous when you began?
The writing wasn't torturous. Writing was a catharsis for me. It was the research that was so tough. I thought I hated those guys before I did the research. After I did the research, then I had created for myself an enemy that I would hate the rest of my life. Fascism, wherever it appears, whether it's in Germany, the United States, the Soviet Union, or anywhere, fascism, wherever it appears, is the enemy.
And yet, at least one of the Germans in that book, and you, at least I came away from almost respecting in a way.
Who's that? I'll get him. Where is he?
The council in San Francisco, the German.
Oh, Rice?
Yeah.
Oh, he just sat around and smoked fancy cigarettes and... I mean, you know, I had to have somebody that I could talk to, you know, in that book on the German side. I mean, fascism and Germany are not that intimately linked. I mean, fascism is a worldwide phenomenon. It can hit, you know, a bunch of baboons swinging in the trees, you know, in Polynesia. You know, they can all suddenly put on iron helmets and march around. Fascism is very much with us today, boys and girls. And still an enemy. I wrote Man in the High Castle with Yi Jing.
You did?
Yeah. I've been sorry ever since. Because when it came time to resolve the novel at the end, Yi Jing didn't know what to do. I mean, it got me through most of the book. Every time they cast a hexagram, I actually cast for them and got something and assigned it to them, and they proceeded on the basis of the advice given. Like when Juliana Frank decides to tell Abbotson that he's about to be off by a Zisher Heights Dean's agent, I threw the coins and she got, you know, warning, make known the truth of the court of the king, great danger, and so on. Someone comes up behind him and hits him with a club. That's what she got. And so that she did go warn Abbotson. If she got another hexagram, I would not have had her go speak to Abbotson. But then when it came time to close down the novel, Yi Jing had no more to say. And so there's no real ending on it. I like to regard it as an open ending. You see, it will segue into a sequel sometime.
When you find somebody with a stomach to write one.
Yeah. Or if Yi Jing ever gets off its ass.
Do you go back from time to time and scroll it to see if there is an ending to it, or?
No, I don't use Yi Jing anymore. I'll tell you, Yi Jing told me more lies than anybody else I've ever known. Yi Jing has a personality. It's very devious and very treacherous. And it feeds you just what you want to hear. And it's really spaced out and burned out more people than that I would care to name. You know, like, like a friend is somebody who just doesn't tell you what you want to hear. A friend tells you what's true. Really, you know. A toady is the old word for somebody who told you what you want to hear. The kings all had their toadies around them, you know, who told them what they wanted to hear. King said, am I the greatest king in the world? Yeah, you're the greatest king in the world, yeah. Well, that's what the Yi Jing does. He tells you what you want to hear. And it's not a true friend. One time I really zapped it. I asked it if it was the devil, and it said yes. And then I asked if it spoke for God and said no. It said, I am a complete liar. I mean, that was in other words, I set it up. I set it up. I asked two questions simultaneously. And it said, I speak with forked tongue, is what it said. And then it said, oops, I didn't mean to say that. But it had already.
Then you get a paradox.
Oh, I watched a girl do this to it once.
I mean, that's the paradox.
So it's
lying when it says it's lying.
Oh, it's just full of, it's crock is what it is. Slotek, John Slotek said this in his debunking book, you know. It's got some, he covers everything from Scientology to the Mafia. He says none of them exist. And he says the Yi Jing, you know, Slotek did a parody of my writing, you know. this is much better than anything I've ever done. Have you read Slotek's parody of my writing? Chip Dick K. Kill.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's so much better than anything that I can do. And I walked around, and I was really off the ground, walking on Cloud 9 after I read the parody. And I wrote Ed Furman, who's editor of FNSF. Those appeared originally in FNSF. And I said, I have talent. Slotek has genius. And Ed Furman wrote back and said, fine, I'm going to buy a lot of stuff from Slotek now. And he did. He commissioned 8 more parodies. And they're all marvelous, you know, parodied Asimov. Slotek said I was the hardest person to parody. I have his book in front of me now. In England it's called Steam-Driven Boy and Other Strangers. Slotek says the Yi Jing's a hoax, and Slotek is right. His parody on me is called Solar Shoe Salesman. And then somebody consults these tiles, and it gives him, Many small greatnesses deny, no same. It does not further to discover gifts only. The wise king avoids fried foods. And I says, ah, Slotek, you finished it off, man. I can never consult the Yi Jing again. And I'll start laughing. I'm looking at this parody and I'm saying, you know, if I could write as well as Slotek. So, that's another thing that brought me back into writing science fiction when I started to talk about being a mainstream writer, you know. We're using science fiction as a crash pad rather than a legitimate dwelling, you know. And I won't do that. If science fiction is going to go down the tubes, I'll go down the tubes with it rather than abandon it. I think it's unfair. You know, if you start thinking you're any good, you leave it. It's unfair to the field, and also it's so like, you know, hubris, right? I'm a great writer, you know, therefore I am not a science fiction writer. Well, what about your first proposition? Maybe you're not such a great writer after all. Maybe you're wrong right there, before you've even gotten to the second part of the proposition.
Maybe a month ago, I was talking, he had Richard Lupoff on the show. Richard Lupoff, good writer, good competent writer, probably best known for what he did for, again, Dangerous Visions, Little Old New Alabama, Benson Boomer Boys, Little Old New Alabama, marvelous story.
Wife's very pretty, too, Pat
yeah.
Lupoff. Tried to pick her up in a bar, didn't know it was his wife. The most amazing thing happened. Found myself out in a parking lot, stretched out flat. Lupoff sure is a short fuse. Oh, go ahead.
He does have a short fuse. That's one of the reasons he's getting out of the field. He says, look, he says...
Wait a minute, he hasn't even been in the field.
He says he's been in it 10 years. He's written novels, short stories, the whole thing.
I didn't know that.
And he's made, you know, maybe 4, 5, 10 grand. He said...
That's nothing. What's that?
He said that...
Is this Lupoff you're talking about?
Dick Lupoff.
He tried to leave the field before they even get into it. No.
Because he was offered big money, he would not say how much, but I gather it was in, you know, better than 15 grand, on personal hypothesis, to write a novel about New York City, I believe, or something in the East Coast.
Dick does have been known disputandum as, you know.
Yeah,
other people can have bad taste and I don't care. That's how you translate that.
He got that, when his agent said he got that kind of money, for writing the mainstream thing.
Makes me really sore. Because we're in a double
too,
we're in a double bind. If we stay in the field, they pay us, you know, pennies.
Yeah.
If you know, nobody's offered me $15,000 to leave the Yeah, maybe Harlan will offer me.
His agent apologized because it was so little, because he said, you haven't, this is a first book. You haven't.
Oh, that's a lot
anything.
Of hype. That's a lot
and
of
Lupoff
hype.
And Lupoff says, what is this? You know, I said, I've been working in the field for 10 years, I'm a competent, good, established writer. He says, that's science fiction. That's not literature.
Oh,
his agent says.
How do you know? Who told you?
Lupoff.
Don't believe anything a writer tells you. I'm a writer. I would know.
I promise.
Always check on your facts when any writer tells you anything. Any fiction writer tells you anything. I mean, a fiction writer is speak with forked tongue. Talk big money. I want to see Lupoff's contract before I believe it. I like to see it.
Spend an evening is ransacking his agent's files.
If somebody offered me don't offer me $6,000 to write a science fiction novel. I mean, to me, that's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money.
But I thought it was.
Considering it's Walheim, considering the fact he's been doing the firm, what, two years, 3 years? Something like that.
Well, he bought a thing for me in 71, so he just started out
there.
It was really funny. He bought the leftovers from the Ballantyne collection that's coming out of my stories. He says, I'll take what Betty Ballantyne doesn't want. And that's exactly what he got. And he was madder than a wet hen, as we say, to use a 10-letter word. He says, I got Betty Ballantyne's rejects. I says, that's what you contracted for. That's what you got. He says, that ain't right. I says, neither is the price. We're still talking, you know, in terms of the same advance that I got when I started out, really. That with inflation, we are getting less advance now. When you factor in the inflation factor, we're getting less money per novel than we did in 1950. I mean, what we could buy with what we got then, we could buy more than what we get now. Doubleday went up to $3,000 advance for me on my new book. I forget the title. Oh, Scanner Darkly. They offered me $3,000. They said that was the most they could go for a science fiction novel. And then after they had acquired it for $3,000, they turned it over to the trade department, which has no limit on what it can offer. And then they told me that the real limit was $4,000, but I have $2,000 to know the difference. And I thought at the time, well, you know, it takes one to know one. They acquired it for $3,000, this new novel of mine, which is just chicken feed, Mike. Let's face it, it's just chicken feed. $3,000, and it took me like 3 years to write the book. You know, it's $1,000 a year. Anybody that wants to write science fiction, and then they're going to market it as a mainstream novel. I mean, they get to sit on both stools. They can eat the porridge out of one pot, and then they eat the porridge out of the other pot. You see, and I got no porridge in at all. And they're going to make a bundle on it, and Ballantyne is going to make a bundle on it, and Ballantyne deserves to make a bundle on it because Julie Lynn Del Rey at Ballantyne went over the manuscript page by page with me. as Scanner Darkly, and told me what it needed to make it into a really competent book. She's able to show me, point for point, this is the first time any editor has ever done that with me since Mannheim Castle. The editor, Pete Israel, was the editor for Putnam then. And he went over Man in the High Castle page by page and showed me how it should be changed. And then now Judy Lynn has done that with A Scanner Darkly. And I've got two good novels under my belt because I had a good editor. The rest of them, they let me flounder around and write whatever came into my head. So it was all uneven. You know, there'd be good parts and bad parts, but it wouldn't add up. Judy Lynn Del Rey, I've never had an editor like her before. She is probably the greatest editor since Maxwell Perkins. She showed me how to create a character, and I've been selling novels for 22 years, and she showed me how to develop a character. Now that really, and my first reaction was, "Dear Judy Lynn, how would you like to take a one-way walk off the Long Beach Pier?" But then I started looking at what she was saying to me, and as soon as my fuse had burned out, you know, getting very short, it didn't take long, I realized that she was teaching me how to write, and it's too bad nobody did that 25 years ago. Because then maybe my books would make more sense. But look for A Scanner Darkly, because there's a master craftsman came into that book, Judy Lynn Del Rey. Now I know what to do when I write a book. You don't just write whatever comes into your head, you just sit there in front of the typewriter. Like when I wrote Ubik, I got about 12 pages done, I didn't have anything I could think of, so I just wrote whatever came into my mind. And I wrote it from my unconscious, is what I did. I turned it over to my right hemisphere of my brain, which did all the thinking from then on. And I was as surprised as anybody as to what came out. And in France, it's considered a great novel, because it doesn't really make any sense. And it's an absurdist thing, a pataphysique in France, you know, and so on. Ever since Jarry hit town in Paris, they loved stuff that didn't make any sense. Maybe it makes sense when you translate it into French. Maybe that's like Poe, when, you know, was it Baudelaire who translated Poe, you know? And made him a great writer in France. Maybe I'm a great writer in France because I've got good translators.
You are better known, I think, sometimes in France than you are here.
In Germany, France, in England, too. They're not translated, though. See, I mean, we speak the same.
Yeah.
You understand?
Two nations separated by
they
the
spell curb with a K there.
Yeah.
That's the only difference.
What did they think of Man in the High Castle in Germany?
Oh, that's heavy. Heavy. They didn't know I could read German. They bought it, a publisher bought it in Germany, and began to translate. And I learned of it, the fact that they bought it. I mean, said, oh no, you're not going to print that in Germany without letting me see the German translation. Says, you get that in the contract, Scott. You insist, and Scott is Jewish. And I says, listen, Scott, we're not going to let them publish that book lest I read the galleys. It's got to be a sine qua non. It's got to be conditioned. And he said, I agree with you completely. And they phoned Germany, and they asked for immediately the galleys. Well, they didn't have galleys. They still just had the typescript manuscript. And they had to send it to us. We made it a condition of the contract. And I got a chance to read it, because I couldn't read German. And I started reading that thing, and they had destroyed that book. They left whole scenes out, whole basic scenes to speed up the action. They had it just turned into a travesty of itself. And I wrote them a letter that they went out of business after they published it, too. You know, look, I actually burst into tears when I finished reading it. I actually cried at what they, see, there was my best novel, right? I mean, really. And they said, we didn't know you could read German. They actually said that in their letter. And they gave me 5 days to read it. That's how they thought about it. 5 days, they said, well, German can't be fluent enough so they can read the whole darn thing in 5 days. But my German got very fluent at that point. I just stayed up night and day with my Cassell's German English Dictionary, and I read every single word, and I compared it line by line with English, and I marked the parts they'd cut out, the parts they had changed. They hadn't changed any of the political parts. All the anti-Nazi stuff was still there. They had just cheapened it into a cheap adventure novel, fast action, fast-paced adventure novel. I remember one part says, Untagomi nannte sein Schießgewehr the Wyatt Earp, and I never mentioned Wyatt Earp in my book anywhere. And in Germany, Mr. Tagomi, he is like Wyatt Earp. Isn't that dreadful? The whole thing was that way.
What about Japan?
There is a Japanese edition, I can't read it. I can read the titles of my English novels in the bio section in the back, and they have, so help me, I'm not putting you on. I don't mean this as a slur against the Japanese, but they said in the English title is Valuable Man instead of Variable Man. That's their problem. But I can't read the Japanese edition. Oh, I wrote the translator. Somebody suggested I write the translator, Japanese translator, and ask him specific questions about the book, and I could tell something about the Japanese edition that way. And he wrote back, and he was really, I thought the Japanese book would be very polite, because I was really wrong. He says, first of all, he says, your book wasn't any good to start with. And he says, secondly, you confuse Chinese culture and Japanese culture. Chinese are inferior people, and Yi Jing is Chinese and not Japanese. So no Japanese would ever use a Confucian classic. So it's only foreigners use those. And he went on like that. And I was really amazed, you know, how upfront he was in his contempt for the book. But the book is still in print in Japan. It sold very well. I made almost $30, $35 off it over a 10-year period. I almost got a check for 40 cents. And Scott had taken 2 cents out. It was 42 cents. It was a book that sold in Tanganyika or someplace like that. Really, no kidding. One copy. And my royalty was 42 cents, and Scott took out 2 cents and sent me a check for 40 cents. And you know that I was so broke I cashed it? I wrote dirty words in the back of it for a long time. You know, I wasn't going to cash it. You know, and I finally went up to the 7-Eleven, you know, and bought a Manhandler meat pie or something. Hand over a 40-cent check, royalty check. I'm telling you,
And they took it?
Well, they kind of laughed at me, but they always laughed at me at 7-Eleven anyway, because my checks always bounce. At least this check didn't bounce. It seems that was Scott's check. One time, four guys from the 7-Eleven showed up at the front door with $285 worth of bad checks I'd written to the 7-Eleven. They said, you got till 5 o'clock to make them good, or you're going to the DA's office. They said, you're going to get in the car now, and we're going to ride around till 5 o'clock. And we did. And I borrowed it from my insurance agent. State Farm insurance agent loaned me the money to pay them. That's the life of the writer. Does that give you an insight? I'm laughing now. I wasn't laughing that day.
And the next book you've got coming out, Phil, is Scanner Darkly?
Yeah.
Anything like the Cordelaner Smith scanners, or...?
No, I don't know. I didn't know anybody used that in the title. What does that mean?
Scanners Live in Vain. One of it was his first, Cordelaner Smith's first SF story.
Suffer and Succotash. Does that mean I got to change my title?
I don't think so. He's dead.
No, that isn't an issue at hand. Well, I know he's dead. That wasn't even his name. No, Scanner right. Darkly, it's from Paul's We See It Through a Glass Darkly.
Oh.
It's a story about a guy who becomes a narcotics agent and then begins to narc on himself. He rigs up a scanner, an infrared scanner, in his own home. And while he's in the home, he feels he's being watched. And then when he goes, you know, to the safe house, you know, he watches reels and reels of tape, you know, video hologram tape, it's set in the future, of what he was doing in the house. And he's so spaced out by the dope he's been taking as an undercover agent that he doesn't know he's narking on himself. He thinks he's two different guys. And when his superiors point out to him that he's really the same guy that he's been reporting on, he flies into a terrible rage, and they fire him. And then he's got to come off the dope because he can't afford to buy it anymore because he didn't have any more money. And his brain is all burned out. And Judy Lynn Del Rey helped me put the book back together so it made more sense. And one of the things that I wrote was this funny suicide scene. I really think there should be more funny suicide things written. I mean, I think that it's a topic of great humor. And this is it. It's very short. It's an insert into the book, and it's self-explanatory, I hope. I hope the whole book makes sense. Judy says it makes sense now. We'll have the first full-length novel that makes sense. The scene goes as follows. Charles Freck, becoming progressively more and more depressed by what was happening to everyone he knew, decided finally to off himself. There was no problem in the circles where he hung out in putting an end to yourself. You just bought into a large quantity of reds and took them with some cheap wine late at night with the phone off the hook so that no one could interrupt you. The planning part had to do with the artifacts you wanted found on you by later archaeologists so they'd know from which stratum you came, and also could piece together where your head had been at the time you did it. He spent several days deciding on the artifacts, much longer than he had spent deciding to kill himself, and approximately the same time required to get that many reds. He would be found lying on his back, on his bed, with a copy of Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead, which would prove he had been a misunderstood Superman rejected by the masses and so, in a sense, murdered by their scorn. And an unfinished letter to Exxon protesting the cancellation of his gas credit card. That way, he could indict the system and achieve something by his death over and above what the death itself achieved. Actually, he was not as sure in his mind what the death achieved as what the artifacts achieved, but anyhow, it all added up, and began to make ready, like an animal sensing its time had come and acting out its instinctive programming laid down by nature when its inevitable end was near. At the last moment, as end time closed in on him, he changed his mind on a decisive issue and decided to drink the Reds down with the connoisseur wine instead of Ripple or Thunderbird. So he set off on one last drive over to Trader Joe's, which specialized in fine wines, and bought a bottle of 1971 Mondavi Cabernet Sauvignon, which set him back almost $30, all he had. Back home again, he uncorked the wine, let it breathe, drank a few glasses of it, spent a few minutes contemplating his favorite page of the illustrated picture book of sex, which showed the girl on top, then placed the baggie of Reds beside his bed, lay down with the Ayn Rand book and unfinished protest letter to Exxon, tried to think of something meaningful but could not, although it kept remembering the girl being on top, and then with a glass of the Cabernet Sauvignon gulped down all the Reds at once. After that, the deed being done, he lay back, the Ayn Rand book and letter on his chest, and waited. However, he had been burned. The capsules were not barbiturates as represented. They were some kind of kinky psychedelics, of a type he had never dropped before, probably a mixture new on the market. Instead of quietly suffocating, Charles Freck began to hallucinate. Well, he thought philosophically, this is the story of my life, always ripped off. He had to face the fact, considering how many of the capsules he swallowed, he was in for some trip. Next thing he knew, a creature from between dimensions was standing beside his bed, looking down at him disapprovingly. The creature had many eyes all over it, ultra-modern expensive-looking clothing, and rows of 8 feet high. Also, it carried an enormous scroll. You're going to read me my sins, Charles Freck said. The creature nodded and unsealed the scroll. Freck said, lying helpless on his bed, it's going to take 100,000 hours. Fixing its many compound eyes on him, the creature from between dimensions said, we are no longer in the mundane universe. Lower plane categories of material existence such as space and time no longer apply to you. You have been elevated to the transcendental realm. Your sins will be read to you ceaselessly in shifts throughout eternity. The list will never end. Know your dealer, Charles Freck thought, and wished he could take back the last half hour of his life. 1,000 years later, he was still lying there on his bed with the Ayn Rand book and letter to Exxon on his chest, listening to them read his sins to him. They had gotten up to the first grade when he was 6 years old. 10,000 years later, they had reached the sixth grade, the year he had discovered masturbation. He shut his eyes, but he could still see the multi-eyed, eight-foot-high being with his endless scroll reading on and on. And next, it was saying, Charles Freck thought, at least I got a good wine.
Oh,
so I just stuck that in. She didn't ask for that. I just this thing that I read, a guy told me that happened to him.
Really?
Yeah. That he had bought what he thought were barbiturates, and everything there is exactly what happened to the guy, except that particular artifacts that he had. I forgot, well, he had a candle or something. But he was going to do it for the archaeologists. You know, he expected them to find him thousands. I don't know what made him think that. Well, I guess I do, because it was 800 pounds of psychedelics that he took. You know, and he still didn't know where he was. But that's what happened to him, you know. And he hallucinated. The cops found him under a bush. He was very fortunate. He was outdoors. And a police car drove by. And he's lying under a bush, you know, with 100 pounds of psychedelics in his tum-tum and his bloodstream, you know, seeing creatures from between the dimensions. And the police car saw him, and he leaped right out and grabbed him and took him to the hospital. They, you know, just drove him right to the hospital. So, like, if he'd done inside, you know, like my character did. This character is never seen again in the book. I just realized. We assume he's still going to be there hallucinating. This guy told me if he'd done it in his bedroom instead of under a bush, that was the only thing that saved him was the cops came in. And I mean, I'm anti-cop all the time, but I think to myself, you know, there's an example of, you know, where you really could use a cop car coming by. The guy, he couldn't get up or talk or anything. He couldn't tell him what he'd taken or anything. Which is, you know, the worst aspect of suicide is where you get into it and you can't get back out and you change your mind. Like people who do it with automobile exhaust and, you know, they turn into a vegetable. Somebody drags them out of the car, you know, and saves them. But, you know, they burned out all our brain cells from the carbon monoxide, which has tendency to do that.
Didn't you tell me when you were on the show before, didn't you tell me you had worked in counseling in a situation like that where you were dealing with drug cases, ODs and so forth for a long time?
Yeah.
That has really got to be one of the grimmest parts of dealing with humanity. Right? Just when you see them in that condition, in that state.
Well, Scanner Darkly is about that, Mike. It's You know, I try to find the ultimate ironies in the drug world, and the ultimate irony would be, you know, like, I remember in the old days, you know, before dope, you could, when you were underage, you were in a bar with fake ID, you know, drinking beer, you know, being real grown up. A guy would come into the bar, and he'd order milk, and he'd be a cop, because he couldn't, on duty, you know, he couldn't, even if he has plain clothes, cop, he was not allowed to order whiskey. So all the underage people get up and leave the bar right away, as soon as somebody come and order ginger ale. They just, we all leave the bar. But the undercover narcotics agents, they have to take pill to be undercover narcotics agents, I guess. I mean, I figure that, you know, that they blow their cover, they're going to get offed, you see. So I presume, you know, that, like, if everybody lights up a joint and there's a narc sitting there, you know, he's going to have to light up a joint. He can't say, no, I'm only allowed to drink ginger ale, because in those circles, they're going to run over, yeah, back over him with their car. So, you know, that's an ultimate irony. And then the dope that the guy takes burns his brain out. And I just tried to pile, you know, see what, you know, how far you could push the terrible tragedies of the dope world. And it'd be where this guy is reporting on himself, and he's too burned out to know the difference anymore. And even when they tell him, and I mean, I remember one thing I saw when I used to hang around with dopers. This guy took me to meet this dude who had a lot of money. And there was this dude, and all he could do was juggle three balls in the air, you know, toss it up and catch them. And I thought, geez, what a poor hedonistic type. You know, the guy's about 30 years old, all he could do is stand around all day juggling these three balls and kind of smiling a lot. And I thought, gee, I guess that's really too bad, you know, probably, you know, moron level, you know. And then I pulled a book out of a bookshelf, and it was Spinoza, and the guy had his book, you know, what do you call it, book plate thing, on the colophon page, I guess, and he had underlined parts, and one time, in other words, he had a brilliant mind, and I could look at the book and see what he underlined, and I could look at the guy standing juggling three balls. I said, well, this guy burned his brain on dope, right? And my friend says, yes, he did. He used to be, in fact, he's got $3 million, you know, he's got everything in the world, and he's burned his brain, nothing left. You can't even ask him what he took. He doesn't even know what he took. He couldn't even tell you what he took. And if you held up the book of Spinoza to him, he wouldn't even recognize. It's worse than Flowers for Algernon, you know, in a way. You know, there's this guy, I could have, you know, I want to get out of here, man. I said, I want to get out of here. I don't want to see this. And I could look at the Spinoza, you know, which is very difficult to read Spinoza. That's probably, Spinoza's the hardest philosopher to read, really. And the guy had underlined parts that meant a lot to him. And there he is juggling his three balls. He can't even do that. And I said, holy goodness. And a lot of other things I said when it began to come to my attention, you know. And I talking to Avram Davidson's ex-wife, Grania Davidson, about that. She did a short story about that and beat me to it in a short story. I hope we don't overlap too much. But her husband, Steve Davis, is a doctor. And he came up with this idea, which I was toying around with, but would be lead poisoning in the air, you know, from car exhaust, that a whole city of people could burn out their brains on, you know, the lead toxins in the atmosphere, and nobody would know it. Like, even the doctors wouldn't know it, because they were inhaling the stuff. And he said, this really could happen. He said, like, it would start out with a doctor finds a hypodermic, used hypodermic lines around somewhere. Of course, you never do that. You never leave, you know, after using hypodermic, you never leave it around. And he would think to himself, there's something wrong. And Steve Davis wasn't a writer. And Grania wrote a short story, which I never read. So she and I talked over this idea. And I was in the hospital after that. I forget what I had. Oh, no, a girlfriend of mine was in the hospital. I went to visit her. And by God, there was a hypodermic lying on the television set beside her. And I thought, you know, this is exactly what Steve Davis was talking about. I mean, you know, maybe everybody, this is Marin County, maybe everybody in Marin County, you know, from the car exhaust or from dope or whatever, a combination of car exhaust and dope has now got to the point, you know, where they're all walking around sideways and nobody knows the difference. You know, and in Scanner, they're all turning on, they're all, nobody knows anything anymore. And it's a terrible thing, you know. Like Tom Dish wrote, you know, Camp Concentration, which I think we discussed when we were on the air before, which I always thought was one of the greatest science fiction novels ever written, where everybody gets very brilliant from getting syphilis, which I always meant to ask Tom Dish where he got the idea that getting syphilis made you brilliant. Although he told me peripherally that Thomas Mann had syphilis. And paresis, in fact, tertiary syphilis. And that the more his brain burned out, the more brilliant he got. And I was going to say the next time I saw Tom Dish, well, you're wrong about that, you know, because camp concentration posits that syphilis will speed up your mentation. Probably it doesn't at all. You can check the opening of Breakfast of Champions, where Vonnegut describes seeing paretics walking around. You know, and a guy can't even step off the curb. He doesn't even know when they get to the curb. Their foot comes up and they fall down, you know what I mean? That's really what tertiary syphilis is. I don't know where, you know, Dish got that. I mean, where Mann and Dish got that idea. But I think my book is sadder than Camp Concentrations, in a way.
Do you find yourself doing a consistent universe in from book to book? I mean, not like Man on the High Castle, obviously, but where you do have a book set in 1981 or 2011, are they essentially the same universe, or does it...
I didn't think they were, but somebody said that they were all essentially the same universe. My basic postulates are always the same.
Which come first for you, situations, characters, or are they sort of interleaved and you can't tell?
Well, first thing is the idea, which is a pure idea. And the next thing is the characters who will be confronted by an environment based on the idea. That is, you create an environment which is a kind of a special effects mock-up of an idea. You translate it from an idea into a world, and then but then you have to have the people who must live in that world. And if my books all have a consistency, it's because my ideas interact with each other. And I always try to find somebody who's the victim of the idea and somebody who is the master of the idea. So you have a bifurcated society always, with the loser, you know, and the winner. You know, somebody's going to make it off the idea, and somebody's going to be victimized by the idea. We just say, you know, make money off. Supposedly use pretzels for money, for example. You know, all the people who own bakeries, you know, would probably, you know, instead of a president, we'd have, the chief baker. You know, see what I mean? And then there's another guy who has a dietary deficiency, and he's got to eat pretzels or he'll die, you see. And so, whenever he's paid off at the end of the month, he has to eat the pretzels instead of using them to buy things with. So I'm making them go on. So they give me his month's pay, and it's in a paper sack, see, a little white paper bag, you know, like you get pretzels in. And he eats the pretzels on the way home, and then he realizes, you know, now he can't pay any of his bills. But his system requires the salt and the pretzels or something like that. So, you know... That's
copyright 1976, Philip K.
I don't know, man. Science fiction has become very much like a silly putty world, you know, in trying to define it. I mean, Publishers Weekly, in their questionnaire that they sent, the first question was, what do you mean when you use the term science fiction? I thought, well, I could spend the rest of my life answering that one question.
Who was it who defined it by saying, science fiction is what I mean when I point at something?
Oh, well, that's Wittgenstein originally, and his idea of definitions by families of connectives, you know. Like, if you look up the word door in Merriam-Webster's 3, the big new Merriam-Webster's, look up something simple like door. A door is a thing standing in a horizontal position as distinguished, or like a chair from a shelf. You know, I mean, the hardest thing in the world to define is the simplest objects, you know. Like that. What is a door?
Define a spiral staircase without using your hands.
No, it's a helical spine. No, that's tautology. They asked, how do you define science fiction? That took me, I finally decided I would answer. It took me 10 pages to answer such, you know, in all. 10 pages to answer, how do you define science fiction? What is the present state of science fiction? And what is its future? It took me 10 pages, you know, and then some little questions, like, who do you think is any good? But the basic question, what is it, where does it stand now, and where is it going? It took me 10 pages to answer.
Who do you think is any good?
In a field? Well, most of the people I think are good apparently are dropping out of the field. So if I say they're good, then they would deny that they were science fiction writers. Tom Dish, Barry Maltzberg, Phil Farmer.
Silverberg?
I don't like Bob's stuff at all. I've never read anything by Silverberg I like. I don't like his stuff. I don't like Carlin Ellison's stuff. I like Spinrad stuff a lot. Catherine Kurtz, I like her stuff. She writes fantasy, I guess. She's also very pretty. Hi, Kathy. I sure like your books. What are they about? I mean, she writes fantasy for Ballantine.
Le Guin?
Well, Jesus said to Pontius Pilate, you said it, not me. Du Zogst in the Luther's translation. Bist du der Judenkönig? And then Jesus answers, Du Zogst. You said it, not me. If that's what you say, Pontius, it's up to you. You're the imperator.
I gotta go wash my hands, excuse me.
That was, you know, that he didn't get off the hook by answering that way. Pilate got off the hook by. I cannot answer about Ursula's stuff. I really don't understand it. Her whole body of writing seems to me to be like a sermonette. Like on the television station used to sign off with a sermonette. A kind of political sermonette. All hooked up and gussied up, you know, with a kind of literary style. But it's all from the poli sci department of University of California in Berkeley, as far as I can make out, when you strip the style away.
You beat out Ursula Le Guin for the Campbell Award in 1975. Flow My Tears, the policeman said, won the award, losing to The Dispossessed, which that year won the Hugo and the Nebula. The whole awards thing, is that essentially a game that the field plays, or does it really have meaning?
Well,
I say this to the man who has at least one Hugo.
Yeah, well, when I learned I'd won the John W. Campbell Award, my first reaction was to refuse the award. Because I was present when the award was given out in Fullerton, and it was a shambles and a mockery and disgrace.
Yeah, I was there too.
You were there too. I was so upset. I went up and made a formal complaint to the university about the whole ceremonies. I mean that I have never gone anywhere and spoken anywhere since that thing. I was so ashamed of every single person up there on that panel. Ashamed for those students who came there to hear us answer their relevant questions with our relevant answers, and they asked relevant questions, and all we did was make fools of ourselves. That I never have ever spoken in public since then. I have become a complete recluse. I've turned out every speaking engagement that's ever been offered me since. Then the next year I went to the W. Campbell Award, you know, and I immediately was going to refuse it. And I was all set. I got very sick with the flu just thinking about having won. I was, you know, my whole, you know, barfed up feeling came back that I had to be the year before when I was folded. But then Harry Harrison called me up, and he described the award ceremony in England. It was given at St. John's College at Oxford. And he said, it isn't like it was when it was given in Fullerton. He said, it was not a shambles and a mockery and a disgrace, you know. And he said it was, and so I finally decided that it was an honor. You know, but I was very reluctant to accept it, and I refused to pose for publicity pictures at the University of California at Fullerton with my award. I refused to do it. I refused to pick up the award, in fact. I wouldn't even pick it up. I made them bring it over to me, and I wouldn't be photographed with the award or with Dr. McNally. I wouldn't have anything to do with any of the PR hype. I told them I was sick, told them I had kidney trouble are a big deal to me. But so anyway, they brought the award over, and then Time magazine interviewed me, and they photographed me, and I was looking through the thing. It's a Mobius strip. Have you ever seen it?
No.
Well, it's a Mobius strip. It looks like something you use to prop up the axle of your car with, you know, if you're changing a tire and couldn't find, you know, a regular bumper jack. And I don't know, Mike, what to think about these awards. Like, I'm ambivalent, you know. It's nice that I won it because it means that, like, Flow My Tears is going to be reissued again because it got the award. It means the book will go back into print next November with a new cover and you know, and the fact that I got the award. So, like, I just split right down the middle. I vote, my left hand votes yes, my right hand votes no on the value of awards. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, shucks, fellas. Gee whiz, you shouldn't have done it. But don't take it back, you know? I was very happy when I got my original Hugo Award. They never told me I got it. I didn't find out until my agent wrote to congratulate me. And I was very excited, and I considered it a great honor. But I think now the awards have become... What is it they give in Canada? They give... There's something, the Elron or something. It's a lemon or something like that. It's for the worst science fiction novel of the year. And I don't know how you accept a word like that. What do you say when they give it?
Harvard does the same thing with the Lacuna Award.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I mean...
Is the field... Well, look, a couple of times you have compared the field to Silly Putty. Is Gresham's Law in Operation, is the bad SF or sci-fi driving out good? Is there less good stuff being printed? Is Sturgeon's Law, Revelation, still in force?
I really do not know, Mike. I really don't know. I have a great anxiety about for the future of science fiction. And when I wrote to Publishers Weekly, I took a very negative view of the future of science fiction. I contrasted the hopes and dreams that we had had for it with now people writing about sword fights and little fellows with fuzzy turned up feet. What is it, Drano and Frito and other
Dildo.
Yeah. That you can't parody science fiction anymore because it's becoming a parody of itself. You know, people think science fiction consists of guys putting on funny-looking old-fashioned costumes and whacking each other over the head with swords, you know, and that's not science fiction. Science fiction is stuff like 1984 to me, dystopias, you know.
Like Man in the High Castle, dystopias.
Yeah. I mean, it's the novel of idea is still the cardinal thing in science fiction. All we got now is tedious sermonettes masquerading as literature. Adventure, you know, space opera. I had a strange experience. I played over a X-1 cassette that somebody sent me for one of my X-1 shows that NBC did in 1954. And it was indistinguishable from the latest science fiction, like Space 1999, is that what it's called, and Star Trek. I mean, mine was as modern in 1954 as what they're doing now.
The one I
played over was Colony. Remember we listened to that thing? And we marveled that in 1954, I didn't do that, I don't take credit for the radio treatment of it. I mean, somebody else did it. But what he was doing in 54, treating my story, was as modern as what they're doing now. You know,
well,
you wouldn't know it was done in 54. It was nothing to give it away.
We're going to find out, because if we have that tape of X-1 called Colony, we're going to run it tonight.
Well, I'll give you my cassette.
We may have it. There's a fellow named Bob Borgen who's given Hour 25 like, oh God, I must have 50 radio shows, Dimension X, X-1, etc. Mm-hmm. If that one is in there, I think it is, we'll run it.
Yeah, I have, there were two of mine, Colony and The Defenders. And it was just scary to listen to it and look on the date, you know, 54. And realize, and here we are in 1976, and we've made no steps forward. You know, we're still, it's still as follows, you know. Captain, there's something hideous on the view screen. Captain says, turn on the laser beams. And then a voice comes out of nowhere, all looking under the seat cushions to see where the voice comes from. And it's talking through an echo chamber and says, I can read your thoughts. I need your assistance. And they say it's a ruse. Get the eagles going. Eagles take off. We know this is a ruse. This is the captain talking from the control room. We know it's all a ruse. You don't need our help. You're going to zap us as soon as we take off to zap you first. And it's, you know, nothing is progressed. I am a superior being. I am a kindly old fellow. You can believe everything I'm telling you because I'm really a computer and would a computer lie? And I thought, oh my God, I just saw that on the air Saturday night. And I said, that's Hal talking again. That's old Hal, you know, shining everybody on. My name is Hal. Would I lie? Would a computer lie? Herb Chaffee. He has an option on an Android Dream Electric Sheep, but I don't dare badmouth his silly movies.
I don't think I'll leave it.
What is that cutting the throat thing you guys keep doing? If you're listening, Herb Jaffe, I love your money. But you sure write lousy scripts, I'll tell you, man. You're a Neanderthal man, is what you are. You're back in the Stone Age. You're back with George Pal. I don't want you to make a movie out of my book. I read the screenplay that they wrote for Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and it was a combination of Steve Reeves and Maxwell Smart. Why are they making all this cutting the throat motion? What is that? And I said, the producer, Robert Jaffe, Herb Jaffe's son, flew down to Fullerton to talk with me about it. Because I didn't think it was a final, shooting script. I thought it was a rough draft, And I says, I'm going to beat you up right here in the airport. I says, you're going to drag me down with you guys and ruin my career if you make a movie out of my book. He says, you mean it's that bad? And I says, yeah. And when I finally says, you mean you wrote that book seriously? He says, you science fiction writers take your writing seriously? I says, I'm serious enough to throw you right out of my car. I said, that's how serious we take it. I says, I'm going to buy that back from you. I'm going to give you the $2,000 option money back. He says, you're serious, aren't you? Then we had about a four-hour rap session, which was very productive. They didn't make the movie. They just continued to hold the option. And I'm hoping they don't make the movie unless they, write a decent script. It was really terrible. I mean, it was the worst script. How bad was it? I'll tell you how bad it was. You could have stopped the first person on the street and asked him to write a script, and he could have done a better job. Really. And there's a guy I know who's into screenplay says it would also cost about $6 million to make it, which is another thing.
You wrote a screenplay of one of your own things.
Yeah, I wrote a good screenplay. I wrote a really good one of Ubik. And it seems to be the fate that the better the screenplay, boy, there's Gresham's Law. I don't know how it applies to science fiction writing in general, but it sure applies to screenplays, that the bad screenplays force the good out. I mean, if given a choice, they will make a movie out of a bad screenplay, and they'll throw the good screenplay back at the author.
If I remember the Rolling Stone piece, that screenplay you did of Ubik is currently bouncing around Europe trying to get financed. Is that still the case, or is that another?
Yeah, it's still option. They're still trying to get financing for it. It's not the director's fault. He spent all the money he had, Jean-Pierre Gorin. And he couldn't get financial backing. He couldn't get the millions of dollars that he thought it would cost. And he got really sick. He got sick with liver trouble, and he had to give up being a director and go teach down in San Diego. And he just about died trying to get a movie made out of that. But I wrote a really great script. I must say, I wish I'd like to read it over the air sometime. There's the funniest scenes in that screenplay that aren't in the book that I added, that I went back to the old silent film days, where there's it's a tragedy. That's the one thing I am bitter about. If I had written a novel with that stuff in it, I wouldn't have any trouble selling it, but I can't sell that screenplay. And it's too bad.
We are close to running out of time. Let me ask you if there's anything in particular that we have not covered that you do want to get on, that you do want to talk about.
Well, let me just make one statement, and that is that I hope people will come into the science fiction field and write science fiction and not listen to people like Silverberg and Malzberg and Harlan Ellison and anybody else you want to name, Vonnegut, who say either they don't write science fiction or they never did write science fiction or they will not write it in the future. I mean, science fiction is a lot of fun to write, and it's worth all the bad financial breaks to do it. I mean, I don't regret that's not true. I regret it when I turn off my electricity. I go through periods, where when I sent off the manuscript of Flow My Tears, for instance, to my agent, I didn't have enough money to send it first class. I had to send it by parcel post, third class mail. I didn't have money for first class post. That's how poor I was. And that's desperation city when you get to the point where you can't pay the postage to mail a manuscript off after it's already been bought. Doubleday had already bought, and on the basis of the outline. So I mean, it's the artist in the garret again. He's going to starve his ass off if he writes science fiction. Nobody will give him any. They'll flip him off every time. He will never get any recognition. He will never get any money. But he will have a hell of a lot of fun. And he ought to know what he's in it for. If he wants to go in for the money, let him go else. But if he loves to write science fiction, let him be prepared for what's going to happen to him. He's going to get no money, and he's going to get no recognition, and he's going to die in the gutter. But he might die happier and more at peace with himself than somebody who's going to make 15 thou doing something he may not want to do. I mean, do what you want to do. I mean, people are stupid if they think they're in it for money. Why did they get in the first place? Whoever promised them a lot of money? Where was Ellison promised a lot of money? You know, where was Maltzberg promised a lot of money? Where did it say when Maltzberg was born that he was promised fame and money? You know, that it's like his birthright, you know, his patrimony. Nonsense. We're lucky that they publish us at all, in a way. You know, they could actually abolish the field of science fiction. And then we really would have to write something else. You know, we're lucky that category still exists. I mean, let's hear it for the science fiction writers who are coming along and still writing science fiction and flip the bird to the people who want money.
The words of Philip K. Dick. This is Mike Hodell for Hour 25.